You're listening to KUOW's The Record. Welcome, I'm Bill Radke. This week is a big deadline for putting initiatives on your fall ballot. Signatures have got to be gathered by Friday. KUOW's Amy Radel tells you why this year there is a frantic race to the finish.
Peter McCollum is the campaign manager for Integrity Washington. His group has raised $1.8 million. Their chances for getting on the ballot in November are looking good.
We've gathered more than 250,000 signatures already, and we're confident that we're going to have around 330,000 at least.
They need 246,000 valid signatures to qualify. McCollum says his measure includes public financing for campaigns.
Initiative 1464 reforms Washington State's ethics and campaign finance laws to create greater transparency and accountability, to limit undue influence of big money in politics, and to give voters in Washington State more of a voice.
But getting the signatures has not been easy. McCollum says signature gatherers often migrate here after California's deadline is finished. But California extended its deadline this year, so the workforce showed up later.
And we did have to pay a little bit more than we anticipated for signature gathering because of the shorter timeline. But that was an adjustment that needed to be made.
Other initiative backers say meeting Friday's deadline will be a challenge. The campaign for restrictions on transgender bathroom access, called Just Want Privacy, has just 150,000 signatures and has raised $180,000. Spokeswoman Kaylee Triller-Haver says they're relying equally on paid gatherers and volunteers.
The paid effort is expensive. I mean, we could contract out at a dollar a signature, but it's not going to compete with these things that are backed by millionaires, where they're getting $4 per signature.
Initiative 1515 would repeal rules guaranteeing transgender people access to the bathrooms and locker rooms of their gender identity.
I think you'll hear a lot of transgender people say, we've been using the bathrooms and locker rooms for 10 years without incident. And I think most of us would agree that's true. Because, honestly, if somebody looks like a female and is being discreet, that's not the issue. Our initiative would just restore that status quo and allow businesses to determine their own policies.
The initiative would also require public schools to keep transgender girls, for example, out of locker rooms when other girls are changing. Failure to do so would be grounds for a lawsuit. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
You're catching up on the news with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle has a new approach to bring health care to people living on the streets, a 39-foot clinic on wheels. Mayor Ed Murray showed it off this morning. KUOW's health reporter Ruby DeLuna was there. Hi, Ruby.
Hi, Bill.
They're calling this a mobile medical van. You got a tour of the van. Take us inside.
Well, it's not a van, actually. It's an RV that's been customized. So when you walk in, you know, there's an area where patients can check in and get their blood pressure checked and all their vitals. And then if you go to the back, there's an exam room that similar to what you will find in a regular clinic, but smaller. There's also a station where folks can meet with a social worker and a mental health provider. And so the idea is to create a one-stop shop for folks.
This is part of the mayor's stepped-up state of emergency response to homelessness. How is it going to help?
Well, you know, people who are homeless have more than other problems than being homeless. They have multiple needs, including health care. And a lot of homeless people have said that they haven't been able to see a doctor in a long time. And often they have chronic conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, and have not been able to get those problems under control. And so this is one way of bringing care to them.
And who will this serve? How many people? How long do we know?
It just started. This program just started. In fact, they just started seeing patients yesterday. And so this is for people who are homeless, whether they've been homeless for a long time or recently lost their homes. And this is a permanent program, though, that's similar to the one that Seattle King County Public Health has been operating since 2008 in South King County. And so this one will concentrate on serving homeless people specifically in the Seattle area. And this was launched yesterday, and it will start scheduling visits to neighborhoods that offer meal programs and other community services to these clients.
Talking with our health reporter, Ruby DeLuna. Ruby, here's my final question about this. The mayor, as you know, has been trying to move people off the streets and out of unauthorized places. Why drive a van around to meet people wherever they are?
Well, because studies have shown, and also in public health experience, you know, they see clients who have a hard time getting to doctor's appointments or any appointments. It's not that convenient. It could take multiple bus transfers sometimes, and it could take a whole day. And so health officials say that by bringing services directly to people, it ensures that their medical needs are taken care of, and it prevents those needs from becoming full-blown and becoming medical emergencies. And as you know, treating those emergencies can be costly.
Our healthcare reporter, Ruby DeLuna, telling you about a new mobile approach to bringing healthcare to people on the streets. Ruby, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And speaking of medical care, we are going to talk later this hour to a man who was homeless, ended up in the hospital in a month-long coma, and his experience there drove him to become a nurse. Well, that and the words of a four-year-old girl. He'll tell you the story coming up here in about half an hour. It's KUOW's The Record. Also in the news today, the Army will open its first therapy center for autistic children, and it will be at Madigan Army Medical Center near Tacoma. The new center comes after years of complaints from military families that it's almost impossible to find good, appropriate, timely therapy for autistic kids. KUOW's Patricia Murphy reports on military affairs. She says this therapy center could be the first of many.
While stationed in Germany, Army nurse practitioner Major Ruth Racine and her husband carved out a promising educational and therapeutic plan for their 7-year-old son Magnus, who has autism. During and after school, he got occupational, physical, and speech therapy.
We were in an absolutely fantastic place for my son through the Department of Defense school system. He was in a developmental program, and he had speech therapy that he was getting inside the classroom, and then we had also lined up speech therapy in the community as well as occupational therapy, and he was starting physical therapy.
But about a year and a half ago, Racine was transferred to Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Tacoma, Washington. Magnus still has some therapy in his new school, but getting the outside help he needs is a problem. Those services aren't available on base, and local therapists in the community are in high demand.
When you call the place to say, okay, great, I have my referral letter, I have my son who needs this, they'll say, okay, great, but right now we don't have room for you. We'll put you on a wait list, and you are on a wait list for 5 different places.
More than a year later, she's still waiting, and so are a lot of other U.S. military families with autistic children at bases around the world. There are 23,000 military dependents with an autism diagnosis, more than 1,000 around Joint Base Lewis-McChord.
That's definitely an issue that we do run into as a whole, I think, as a military community.
Gretchen Shea is a regional administrator for the online group American Military Families Autism Support. Her husband is in the Navy, stationed at Whidbey Island, Washington. They have 2 children with autism.
There's options there, but the wait lists are there because everybody needs either after school or there's only, you know, 1 or 2 speech therapists for a huge area.
The situation is so bad that when Penn State University conducted a survey of military spouses, about 80% say they've had difficulty obtaining services for their children. Now, next to this preschool at Washington's Joint Base Lewis-McChord, the Army plans to take a small step to address the problem. Inside this repurposed child development center will be the Army's first standalone therapy and education facility for children with autism and their families. Lieutenant Colonel Eric Flake is a doctor and the director of Madigan Army Medical Center's Developmental and Behavioral Pediatric Program.
There's going to be programs to teach parents as they have a new diagnosis. A large focus will be in some group after school type of therapy opportunities. Additionally, during the workday, this will also be a therapy center where kids will get direct speech therapy, will get direct occupational therapy.
He hopes by early next year, the center will take some of the pressure off families and help a lot of kids.
We anticipate great outcomes, ones that will be measured, ones that will be identified, and we'll be able to report those back and demonstrate that impact.
Major Ruth Racine says it'll make a big difference for her family.
My husband sent me the link for the Facebook page about the program, and tears came to my eyes immediately because as a parent, this represents hope.
But Gretchen Shea from the Military Families Group has mixed feelings about the project. The center will only serve 150 children at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. While she's happy those families will benefit some, she says the Department of Defense needs to do a lot more to serve autistic children everywhere.
That's a great start. I do feel that it's kind of just a drop in the bucket.
Neither the Army Surgeon General's Office nor the Defense Health Agency would speculate about the future of the program. They haven't said whether they might build similar programs at other bases to serve the thousands of other autistic military children whose parents are struggling to find timely care. I'm Patricia Murphy, KUOW News.
Her story was produced by the American Homefront Project, which is a collaboration among KUOW, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, Southern California Public Radio, and WUSF Tampa. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This is what today's Raleigh, North Carolina Republican presidential campaign rally sounded like. Will Donald Trump be our next president? And even if he won't, has Trump's candidacy changed the Republican Party forever? Leading Washington State Republicans have been debating this question, and last week in Bellevue, four of them hashed it out at a public forum moderated by Ross Reynolds. The panelists were former State Attorney General Rob McKenna, State Representative Matt Manweller, KVI radio host John Carlson, and Republican U.S. Senate candidate Chris Vance. Vance cannot stand Donald Trump's candidacy, and he blames, among others, the Republican National Committee.
Where was the RNC months ago? At some point, the RNC should have said, you know, really, I don't really care how many delegates you win or how many votes you get. You cannot be the nominee of this party.
How could they ignore the Republicans who voted?
Well, we're going to find out at the convention whether or not the party matters. Because the Republican and Democratic parties actually matter. And they're governed by people who've dedicated their lives to the Republican and Democratic parties. And by opening up the process so wide, we've allowed people, you know, someone who was, like I said, a registered Democrat just a few years ago to now take over one of the two major political parties. I'm afraid it's going to keep on happening. What needs to happen is the two parties need to choose their nominees, and then the American people can decide if they like them or if they want to vote for someone else. But the basic answer to your question is we're reaching the point where the parties are meaningless because they can't control their own message.
When you say the parties have to decide, you're not defining the parties as most of the voters in those parties who voted.
I'm talking about people who are dedicated to the Republican or Democratic parties.
Not someone who just goes in and votes.
That's right.
John Carlson.
Chris, he won fair and square.
Sure, under these rules. I think these rules are insane.
Well, he won because voters voted for him. I didn't vote for him, but the voters voted for the man.
Right.
Donald Trump got just as large a proportion of votes in Republican primaries and caucuses as Mitt Romney. He got a larger proportion of Republican votes in the caucuses and primaries than John McCain did 4 years before that. So you can complain about the results. Like I said, you and I both had what we thought were better candidates early on, but the bottom line is the guy won fair and square. And by the way, while we're talking about keeping your word, remember when Donald Trump first ran and he wasn't clear on whether or not he would run as a third party or not? This came up in the first debate, I think. Mm-hmm. Will you sign a pledge to support the nominee? And at first he hedged, and then he said, yes, I will, and he actually called a press conference and signed the pledge. Okay. Look at some of the other candidates like Jeb Bush and Lindsey Graham, as if it matters, but still, on principle, who signed that pledge who aren't supporting the winner. What about honor on their part? Didn't they sign that same pledge that the media made such a big deal about Donald Trump signing, that the party made such a big deal about Donald Trump signing? Well, if it matters for him to do it, why doesn't it matter for them to do it?
Well, right after the Wisconsin primary, Donald Trump said he wouldn't bind himself against that either way. He broke his pledge.
And finally,
but they never should have made that pledge.
Well, that's what you told the reporter for King. I didn't know he was going to do so well. Mm-hmm. Well, he did. Mm-hmm. And finally, I want to address the point that Rob made. Rob, I think that you actually laid the groundwork for why Trump might be a successful president, and that is the gridlock in Congress. Both parties is really driven by ideology. It's made both caucuses quite rigid. You can argue, really, that the Democratic caucus is afraid of their left flank and the Republican caucus is afraid of their right flank. Maybe the kind of president who could break through that is a consummate deal maker who's not ideological at all and has played in both parties.
Rob McKenna, is the deal maker of The Apprentice going to be the deal maker of between with Congress and with foreign powers? Should he be elected?
I do think he's more likely to try to work with Congress and broker deals. I think that's true. I don't think he's going to win for the reasons I already mentioned, which breaks my heart because any number of other people who could have been nominated, I think, would be ahead
of
Hillary.
Any of the other 16?
Well, certainly some of them were polling well against her for months, that's for sure. But I think compared to President Obama that he could conceivably do better because he does know how to negotiate. And President Obama couldn't bring himself to negotiate with Republicans in Congress in good faith. They tried. Boehner tried. Ryan has tried. He wouldn't do it. And we shouldn't be surprised that he wouldn't do it because he had no track record of success as a member of the Senate or as an Illinois state legislator. He never accomplished anything of substance in his prior positions. Why would we suddenly expect him to become a brilliant deal maker with Congress a la Reagan or even Clinton, who at least, was willing to adopt the agenda of Gingrich for welfare reform and other items to get them done. He got things done because he could work with Congress, but not Obama. So but in contrast to Obama, he'll probably do better. And we certainly need that.
Matt Manweller, why this year, 2016, has Donald Trump's insurgent candidacy been so successful? Some would argue that this is the logical conclusion of a series of actions taken by Republicans over the past 4 or 5 years, but you have a theory about this.
I have an answer, and it's outside what you read in the mainstream media. Everybody is focusing on anger, frustration with the establishment. I have a different take on it. It's probably a little bit more nuanced, and probably a lot of people will disagree with it, but I think that Donald Trump is a reaction to the shaming of disagreement. So political debate used to take place in, I believe I'm right, I believe you believe I'm wrong, let's look at the data, let's argue. But political debate has shifted into more of a Hester Prynne, if I disagree with you, I'm going to make you wear a scarlet A on your chest. And then I'm not going to simply disagree with you. I'm going to shame you. I'm going to shame you on Facebook. I'm going to shame you on Twitter. I'm going to silence you with that shame. I'm then going to go after your business. I'm going to convince people. The shaming shifts to shunning, right? And now that I've shamed you, I'm going to try to convince everybody not to go to your restaurant, not to hire you. And so the shaming leads to the silencing of dissent.
So you're saying Donald Trump is the guy who will not be shamed?
Well, what I'm saying is that he is shameless. And as a result, let me give you an example.
Or right? Shame-free.
Shame-free, right? I was talking with a woman, and this is serious. She was a rape victim, and she came out opposed to the bathroom rule. She says, I was a rape victim. I'm traumatized by that. I don't want men in my shower. So what was the response? I'll talk to you. Let's talk about data. No, you're a bigot. You're a racist. So she is silenced, and she says, I don't talk about it. But when you shame people into silence, you don't change their mind. You just create incredible resentment. And that resentment manifests itself in Donald Trump. I can't say I want to build a wall because you'll call me a racist. I can't say I don't want men in my shower because you'll call me a bigot. But I can vote for Donald Trump and he can say it for me.
That is State Representative and political scientist Matt Manweller from Kittitas County with former Washington Republican Party chair, current U.S. Senate candidate Chris Vance, KVI host and former candidate for governor John Carlson, and Rob McKenna, also a former candidate for governor and a former Washington State Attorney General. Four Republicans debating their party's president future at an event in Bellevue produced by KUOW, moderated by our own Ross Reynolds. We called that session the elephant in the room, and you can hear the entire excellent hour-long discussion at our website. Go to KUOW.org and search Elephant in the Room, and we'll tweet out a link to that conversation right now at KUOW. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Picture the typical Amazon worker. Young, male, laser-focused on the tech world. Well, in her series, Art of Our City, KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman introduces you to a different kind of Amazon badger.
When it comes to Amazon, Varsha Raghavan knows what outsiders think.
It's easy to stereotype a large group of people. You know, say we're tech bros or like amholes, or I've heard all of it.
Raghavan's no bro, although she does have a master's degree from MIT. And this petite 24-year-old with the killer smile can do something most bros can't, belt out a show tune.
I need a sad boy, I need a bad boy.
Varsha Raghavan's parents came to the U.S. from India. Their only child excelled at math and science. But young Varsha was extremely shy. Her parents thought theater camp would help her break out of her shell.
Well, I recall coming back home to my mom one day and being like, Mom, being on stage is the only true happiness in life.
Raghavan's parents told her they didn't move thousands of miles from home so their daughter could become a starving artist. 8 years later, Varsha enrolled at MIT. But she devoted every spare moment to the college a cappella group. She took a job with Amazon's drone program in part because of Seattle's thriving theater scene. Raghavan isn't ready to trade in technology for musical theater yet.
About once a week, I look up MFA programs.
Varsha Raghavan understands why longtime Seattleites resent the changes wrought by the influx of young techies like her. She tells them, just try to keep an open mind.
Amazon employees are artists, we're philanthropists, we're social justice warriors, all the kinds of things that I feel like this city needs and wants.
He's gotta be hopeless with jeans so tight.
That's the Art of Our City. I'm Marcy Silman.
When he should be happy, he's so depressing. That's what I need tonight.
It's what she needs. You can see Varsha sing, and you can catch up on all of Marcy's Art of Our City reports at our website, KUOW.org, and on social media. Search for the hashtag Art of Our City. And you can see art in our city in person for free tomorrow, because it's First Thursday, when art galleries in Pioneer Square and all over the city open up free of charge and launch new shows. The question is, what to see? Jen Graves is art critic for The Stranger. She's got a recommendation for you.
So you want to go to Rock the Rue Gallery, where they're having the last exhibition ever. It's a great gallery.
Soto.
And you want to go because Amanda Monatok, a Seattle artist, is showing drawings, some of them large-scale drawings. They're all made with a pencil. Of words against patterns. And the words are taken from things her boyfriend has said and various other miscellany, but mostly from the words of Frances Farmer.
Okay, so before I ask you why would I want to go look at words, let's talk about this actress, Seattle actress, in a Nirvana song, who is Frances Farmer.
She was an actress who grew up in West Seattle and made her biggest movie in the 1930s. She had a very colorful life. She was accused of being an alcoholic. She has had movies made about her life because she was in Western State and there were questions about how she was treated. And
Jessica Lange movie.
Jessica Lange movie, 1980s. Mm-hmm. She essentially was a very criticized woman in a very critical time. And she was beautiful and she was treated as though that were what really mattered about her. And she wanted to be taken seriously as an actress and had a very, very hard time being taken seriously.
Why?
She was very different. She was very beautiful. And those are two different things, obviously. When she was in high school in West Seattle, she wrote, she won a scholarship for some scholarship money for an essay that was based on Nietzsche. And it was about God is dead and about how she is not an atheist, believing that God never existed, but she has no proof of him in her life, and therefore she, you know. And
which is bold for a 1931 high school girl.
Extremely bold. She was always extremely bold. So being beautiful, not obedient, she was under siege, really, by a culture that just wanted to see her as a visual surface.
So what? Okay, so that's Frances Farmer. And what is Amanda Montauk?
Mm-hmm.
What is she doing with the idea of Frances Farmer in this Seattle exhibit?
Well, what she's doing is she's taking Frances Farmer's voice, or a voice that is purporting to be Frances Farmer's. I think some of these are quotes, but the question of sort of exactly where the quotes came from, or, you know, whether they're precise is open. She's taking that voice and making it visual. So she's replacing the image of Frances Farmer with the words of Frances Farmer, or words that you can attribute to Frances Farmer. So there is a little bit of kind of unsureness about what's Frances Farmer, what's Amanda Montauk.
And tell me about the artist, Amanda Montauk. What interests you so much about her?
Amanda Montauk is not from here. She's from very, very, very religious sort of Pentecostal, speaking in tongues, Texas household. She went to Oral Roberts University. It was sort of considered the only place, the only proper place to really go. And when she first came to Seattle, one of the things she was doing was drawing. She's very, very interested in the invention of hysteria in the 19th century as a sort of female problem. And the writhing that happened in those spaces really reminded her of the speaking in tongues she had to do, right? And/slash got to do. I mean, she's not entirely sort of anti her own experience, right? She's not a Christian religious fundamentalist by any means, but she has that experience in her body, and it's in her art too.
I know just a bit about what hysteria, the idea of it. Tell me about that.
So the way that hysteria was studied and diagnosed was that women were out of control and their bodies were writhing and they were moaning, and you know, there are these associations with orgasm and with kind of and with anger and with all these uncontrollable, uncontainable desires and expressions. And so she certainly associated that with the uncontainable expressions in the church that she saw being sanctioned as a kid, as opposed to being punished or treated.
That's fascinating. So how do you think that, what do you think that has to do with this Frances Farmer show?
Such a good question. So one thing you're going to notice when you see these pieces is that the letters are totally straight. The font is steady. It's not handwritten. And the backgrounds are writhing. So you're going to see this very disjointed, you know, visual experience between the sort of stiff, you know, stiffness of the voice and the uprightness, and then this kind of writhing, shadowy presence in the background, which she always has there, this sort of madness that's lurking there. And the tension between the two is really where the work exists.
Amanda Montauk's show is called Nothing Left to Say. It opens at Rock LaRue in Seattle's Soto Pioneer Square neighborhood tomorrow. Jen Graves told you about the show. She's the art critic for The Stranger. Enjoy First Thursday. If you've been listening to KUOW's The Record all hour, you heard about Seattle's new mobile medical van helping people on the streets. Now I'd like to introduce you to a man who used to be homeless. Eric Seitz left home and left his family when he was 16 years old. And he bounced around, traveling, couch surfing. Then he got into drugs, and his couch surfing devolved into living on the streets. At that point, Seitz figured he wouldn't live past 25 years old, and he was okay with that.
It was just a strange sense of kind of pseudo-contentment in what this position that I was in, and also just not thinking that there was any way to get out of it, having tried to do it many times before. So I just kind of thought that was my lot in life.
Then Eric got a bad leg infection after injecting heroin there, and he very nearly did die.
I have the sensation of waking up, and I was waking up in Harborview in the hospital. I don't know how I'd gotten there when I woke up, because I saw my mom there that I hadn't seen in probably 6 months or something. And they told me that I'd been in a coma for the past month. And I didn't really know what had happened. So I thought thought it might have been an overdose, but then what they told me was that I contracted the flesh-eating bacteria there in my leg, and they said that it had pretty much destroyed the entire, all the flesh on my right leg in about one day.
Eric, you told me earlier that you had long since accepted the idea that you might not live past 25.
Yeah.
So given that, how did waking up from a near-death experience, what did that do to you? What went through your head then?
Pretty much since I had not had any complications with drug use before that, it kind of contributed to the fact that I kind of thought that I was invulnerable in some kind of way, or that like I wouldn't die, but I was fine if it did. But at that time, I had the realization that it had just gotten real, and I could see the look on other people's faces, and they were horrified. I did feel that I wanted to live at that point because it was such an intense experience.
How did that affect you waking up from a month-long coma and seeing your mom's face? You hadn't seen your mom in 6 months or so.
It was not really shame or guilt, but it was kind of some kind of remorse that I hadn't connected with my family, who I love very much and were always there for me anyways. I just wish that I didn't have to go through that experience to find myself. But I was actually pretty relieved in a way. I felt like I could like breathe again in a way, knowing that I had the support still, because there was all my family members were visiting me during that time, and I apparently had my 24th birthday in a coma, and all my family came in party hats and celebrated that. So it was definitely kind of relieving in a way, actually.
What happened after you recovered? You left the hospital.
Yeah, so it's, I would assume, as most people would going through that experience, that would be enough of a trauma to just not want to ever do that again, like almost dying. But I found out that death for me wasn't the bottom. And so I went right back out again after all that, and it was about $900,000 in the hospital bills and those months in Harborview. And I didn't even go back to the drug of choice. I went to something else, and eventually I did that. But it was just, I did that and tried to hide it for another month or two until it was pretty obvious that I had fallen down again. But it was just so dedicated to like still staying in that lifestyle for some reason, because that's all I really knew. And it was, you know, pretty horrifying to realize that I was willing to accept death again after all that experiences. And
yeah, we talk about people hitting bottom. It sure sounded like you hit bottom.
Yeah, sounded like it. But it was something else that I went through that really got me to have some introspection on what I was doing to other people as well. And it was something that my little niece said, and she was probably like 4 or 5 at the time, and she didn't really know what was going on, but she knew something was up, and she could sense emotional stuff like that. And so she came up to me and asked me why I didn't love her anymore. And that's what really kind of...
Why you didn't love her?
Yeah. She felt like I wasn't really paying attention to her or showing her, obviously, the respect that she deserved. So that was what really got me to think about it. And from that day on, I didn't use anymore again and really tried to do what I could to get away from that.
Why? What went through your mind when your 4-year-old niece says that to you?
Again, just like seeing how I was affecting other people, and I really like loved her a lot, and just the innocence that I saw there and her desire just to have an uncle in her life was really important to me. And I still had some kind of moral and value system set up that it was strong enough to get me to stop that. Like, obviously I didn't care about myself at the time, but I have a lot of empathy for other people and love for other people at least. And so that kind of held me together for a while until I could love myself again.
Isn't that interesting? You know, you might think that self-love or self-preservation would be enough, or seeing all those friends and family members around you, but it was that 4-year-old little girl that kind of triggered something for you.
Yeah, definitely was. From that moment on, I didn't really have any cravings or obsessions about using anymore, which was strange. It was just kind of taken from me.
Really?
In a way, I don't know why. But, I mean, it was hard sometimes because I would think about it, but it wasn't, like, serious enough where I'd actually wanted to go back again. It was kind of some weird spiritual experience, in a way.
What about the rest of your family? How did you rebuild that? I mean, you needed help, I would think.
Yeah, and luckily enough, I had that family support system there, which, I mean, the people that I was hanging out with a lot didn't have that, and so I could see how that would keep them out a lot longer. But when I asked for the help, I got it, which is very privileged for me. And I'm grateful for that, but that's one of the biggest contributing reasons of why I feel like I need to dedicate my life to giving back to those that are still in that situation.
Yeah, let's talk about helping other people in a couple of ways. For one, you are a nurse now.
Yeah.
Right? How did that come about?
That was just purely from the experiences that I had had as a patient in Harborview. I woke up and I was always really interested in like chemistry and biology, even though I was never planning on doing anything with it. I just wanted to be a traveling hippie guy for the rest of my life. But when I got into that situation and it was, and I was the subject, it was just really fascinating to learn about how the body worked and how healing worked. And it was kind of a challenge to me to redirect my thinking somewhere else and my purpose somewhere else. And so that's really what started it.
As you know, we're debating and arguing over how to help homeless people. What would have helped you the most so that you didn't have to end up in a 1 month coma?
It would have been nice to have like some house, like supportive housing to go into that was at least covered for the period of while I was trying to figure out my stuff. A lot of people don't want
supportive housing, meaning
like subsidized housing. I mean, there's a lot of those downtown.
Plus counseling.
Counseling,
services.
Yeah, because I think that mental health care in Washington is appalling in a way. Just we have a pretty bad record for that.
And how about a place where you could keep using the drugs you want, but supervised?
Mm-hmm.
Would that have been helpful or hurtful?
I think that would have been extremely helpful. I mean, I've had a lot of contact with the supervised injection facility up in Vancouver, Insight, to try and get some inspiration on how we could do that down here. And I've been a part of the conversation of doing that down here in Seattle as well. But I think those kinds of things, like safe consumption rooms, are something, again, like to keep someone alive long enough where if they want to get out of that or not, like they'll have that opportunity. And it's the same thing with homelessness, like giving somebody an opportunity to have the capacity to do something different.
That is Nurse Eric Seitz telling you what it took for him to get off heroin and to find a stable home. So how does Eric think we can get better at helping people out of homelessness? For starters, he says, get out and volunteer. Meet the people who are living on the street and try to feel empathy for the people who are struggling around you. Well, as there is in Seattle, there's a homelessness problem in British Columbia. One example, about 100 people have been living in tents for months on the courthouse lawn in Victoria. Now a judge has ruled, shut it down. Here to fill you in on that is not the vacationing Vaughn Palmer, but Stephen Quinn, host of On the Coast from CBC Radio 1 in Vancouver. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Bill.
Why did the judge rule against the people living on the courthouse lawn?
The judge said that over the past couple of months, the conditions there had deteriorated significantly. The BC government actually went to court in April looking for an injunction then to shut the camp down. They were refused then because the judge said there wasn't enough of a case for it. He said this time around that there's been an increase in crime. There are health risks like rats. There are discarded needles and condoms. That there's been a breakdown in leadership. And he said this time around, for the safety of the people living in the camp, they need to shut it down. And also for the residents who live nearby the camp as well, because a lot of them have been afraid to go out at night. They don't like what they're seeing there. There are allegations that there's some criminal gang activity or, you know, some drug selling going on inside the camp as well. The numbers have kind of dropped from, you know, probably 120 people at its height down to about 80 people now. And people have been moving out as the provincial government has been able to find housing for them. The government's taken over a number of properties and is renovating them or refurbishing them, trying to get these people into the camp. So for all of those reasons, the judge said as those places become available, people should be moved into them. And by the second week of August, the camp needs to be shut down.
Okay, so that's what happens to the people living outside Victoria's courthouse. They get moved into housing. And what do the people living there say about that?
Well, you know, people who have been speaking on behalf of the campers say, yay, this is a big victory because more than 200 housing units have been created since this thing started. And they said that's really what what this camp and to the extent that it is a protest was about securing some kind of social housing for them. So they're saying that's certainly a victory. There are a couple of holdouts. The Victoria Times Colonist newspaper spoke with someone, Chrissy Brett, who said, you know, she's not going to go anywhere. She's trying to make a point saying, you know, this is great for the homeless people who have been in the camp that they're going to find housing. But there are still lots of homeless people on the streets of Victoria and certainly thousands of homeless people across the province. And until the provincial government does something for all of those people, she says the point's not made. She's going to be staying. She's not going anywhere, she says.
Okay, so there's living in a tent. Now we are going to segue and talk about recreating in a tent. Mm-hmm. Stephen, campsites can be hard to come by in British Columbia, same as they are around here. And I understand that tour companies there are accused of making the situation worse.
Yeah, this is getting a campsite in BC is a little bit like trying to get tickets to a Radiohead concert or mm-hmm. something. You know, you have to, the minute the tickets are going to go on sale, you put everybody in your family in front of one device and all in front of the screen. And as soon as the clock hits the hour, you start trying to get it. That's actually how people are trying to book campsites in BC. You can do it 3 months in advance. They release them 3 months in advance. But tour companies, specifically tour companies that specialize in putting Europeans into RVs, have been snapping up all of the campsites and they resell them as part of their tour package. So a campsite could be going for, you know, $15 to $35. It's at least $70 by the time the tour company gets a hold of it, and they roll these into the packages. And it's not just the tour companies. I mean, this is just like concert tickets again. This is like these show up on Craigslist as well. I saw one today for two nights in Porto Cove, which is on Howe Sound, lovely spot. That's $125. There's a lovely one near Tofino, asking price for that one $160 for two nights. People are seeing the opportunity in this, shall we say. So it's not just the big tour companies, but some individuals jumping on this bandwagon as well. And it's frustrating for, you know, those of us who remember the days when you would drive until dusk and go, oh, there's a campsite, and pull in and set up your tent. You know, you have to make plans well in advance.
Yeah, and you can't if all the spots are gone within minutes because they're getting snapped up. But the right thing is, it's legal, Stephen, so what could be done about that?
Well, first off, to be fair, only about half of the campsites in provincial parks are reservable to begin with. So there is still a first-come, first-served element there. What can be done about it? The provincial government really isn't interested in doing anything about it. The Ministry of the Environment said, we don't see any problem here. Those tour companies are an important part of tourism in BC. We think things are working just fine. Maybe we'll take a look at it when the season is over. But there's a man by the name of Sam Waddington. He's a city councillor in Chilliwack. He also happens to run an outdoor company. He says New Zealand has a good system of campground reservations. He says it gives some priority to local residents. It also includes a lottery business. But he says ultimately what needs to happen is the government needs to create more campsites. Because what happens is the campsites get full, people go off into the backcountry and, you know, to what aren't recognized as campsites at all, and leave their junk there and hurt the environment. So it would be to the advantage of everybody if we had more places to camp in the province.
There's an idea. We can relate to that down here, Stephen Quinn. Thanks for talking with us.
Bill Radke, thank you so much.
Host of On the Coast, CBC Radio 1 in Vancouver. See you, Stephen.
See you, Bill.
On KUOW's The Record, we've been filling you in on the news of the day. And here's one more thing. The quarterback of the Seahawks has remarried.